Another big man on the campus, especially in size, was Dr. Christopher Longis, professor of Spanish and registrar while I was an undergraduate, and for a brief interim period, chancellor. He cultivated the reputation of being very rough on his students. His classroom was on the third floor of Lyceum front, and when the weather was warm and the windows were open, you could hear him sometimes all the way down to the flagpole. Now, all European languages, as far as I know, pronounce the vowel U as a pure vowel, like the Greek vowel upsilon. But in many English words, we pronounce it as though it had a Y in front of it, like union, usury, not to mention you. Thus, it turns out that beginning students have difficulty with the Spanish word for you, which happens to be usted. And at times, as I say, I have heard him all the way down to the flagpole absolutely shouting to a student, usted, say it, sir, say it, I say it, usted. I've been told that one day a spunky co-ed snapped back at him after such tirade, and he looked at her in silence for a minute, and then broke out in uproarious laughter, saying, "Now, young lady, let's don't get too excited about this thing." In those days, when I came back to school to teach in 36, everyone called on new faculty on Sunday afternoons, 3 to 4:30, or maybe 5. Ladies with hats, white gloves, and everything. And the calls had to be returned just as punctiliously. Babysitters were not too common in those days, and besides, I didn't care to leave my young children with a black girl. So we used to take our three youngsters with us. I'm sure it must have scandalized the local people, but it helped teach them manners. And besides, they would get restless after 10 or 15 minutes, and that gave us an excuse to leave. We were returning a call to the longest one Sunday. And Dr. Longis, to make conversation, asked, "By the way, did you by any chance ever come across a man called Curlmar at Hopkins?" Now, Curlmar was chairman of German and responsible for giving the reading examinations in German to doctoral students. He hated it with a passion, and he let everybody know it. And in general, he was pretty rough on the examinees, so I answered unthinkingly, but honestly, and out of my own experience, indeed I did. He's the biggest unhung scoundrel I ever came in contact with at Hopkins. Well, Dr. Longis put his head back and simply roared, "He was my best friend at Hopkins," he said. But he added, he was a little rough on students, wasn't he? He also told me something one time that illustrated the difference between the small faculties then and the large ones now. Dr. Longis was a huge man who walked with a decided limp. He told me it was because he had broken his leg playing football at Ole Miss. And do you know, he said, Dr. Hume called on me in the infirmary every day I was in there. Professor James Warsaw Bell occupied the first house on what we called B Street. There were four white frame two-story houses on the walk leading down to the railroad, beginning about where the new law center is. These three or four one-story frame houses just down the hill weren't there then. We called that B Street, since the houses were occupied by Bell, Bishop Bondron, and Brown. Jim Warsaw, as we called him, was from Pontotoc. He had an M.A. from Ole Miss, and although He had done summer work at various and sundry northern universities, no other degrees. He cultivated the image of an unabashed country boy and of being very imperious towards his student. I'm sorry to say that he appeared to me to be a very superficial teacher. I had political science under him, and what I remember is he had a loud and raucous voice and was very overbearing. All that I learned from his class was the title of our textbook and the name of its author, which I have forgotten, and the fact that the supreme law of our land is the Constitution of the United States and the treaties which have been ratified by the Senate under its provisions. He was, however, a shrewd administrator and the first dean of our business school, and I believe a successful one. He was a perpetual chairman of the athletic committee. He was very much interested in all athletic and alumni affairs and prided himself on keeping abreast of all the political winds blowing over the state. The great Bilbo shake-up in 1930, however, caught him completely by surprise. Dr. Kennan told me that it was a funny sight to see him the day the news broke, if there was anything funny about that situation. It caught Jim Warsaw completely unaware, and he was aghast, and I imagine a little frightened, but he was not fired. Dr. Calvin S. Brown lived in the last house on B Street. He was professor of modern languages, and he taught French and German. They didn't have all the electronic equipment of a modern language laboratory in those days, so he tried to teach by a method which was about halfway between the oral method used today and the straight translation method used in Latin and Greek. I'm sure his accents were getting defective by the time I got him in class, but he was excellent on grammar, and we got a great deal more out of reading Pascal, Corneille, and Racine under him than under one of his native-born instructors who taught our class for a week or so. He was a great admirer of the German university system, where the Herr Professor was absolutely the top dog, and he had the reputation of being a very hard and demanding teacher. But I soon observed that if you stayed with him, he would pound enough into your head to get you passed. I really believe that he reasoned that if a student dropped his class, that just saved Calvin S. the unpleasantness of flunking him. In those days, German was an absolute requirement of the pre-med curriculum. And in later years, after I returned to teach, I talked many a pre-med student out of cutting out of his class and accepting an F. Stay with him, I would advise the boy. Don't let him frighten you into quitting. If you stay with him, he'll teach you enough to pass the course. And I was rarely wrong. All his children grew up speaking both French and German as well as English. A popular rumor was that they spoke English, French, and German at home on successive days, and woe to the youngster who forgot and came out with the wrong language. He also told us one day that he had tried a learning experiment with his children. While getting his passport verified one day in a Turkish port, he was struck by the fluent way in which the officer wrote his Turkish or Arabic script from right to left, and then how clumsily and painfully he wrote Calvin S. Brown from left to right. So when they were at the right age, he taught them to look at their picture books upside down, see if they could learn to do that. They did. They soon got used to that and soon learned to read the letters upside down and from right to left. I've often wondered how the school teachers unscrambled them when they finally got to first grade. Then there was Dr. Alfred Hume. Mrs. Hume called him Allie. The students called him Little Allie because he was a small man and tried very hard to make it sound very irreverent. He was a very erect, small man, gray-haired, very grave, very reserved, very dignified. One of the finest teachers I ever had. Exacting, but clear, logical, and precise, and withal, patient. For all the fear he engendered in indifferent engineering students, I never knew him to address a student in anything but the most courteous manner. I knew only one instance in which he seemed to be abrupt with a student. One day, a very indifferent student, he was rarely well prepared, asked him to work on a sine problem in analytic mechanics. Dr. Hume proceeded to put the problem on the board and very shortly turned and remarked that it was now obvious that we should exchange the angle theta for the half angle theta 2. It really was obvious. That done, the answer literally fell out. His questioning student, however, couldn't resist trying to justify himself, so he said, "That certainly is neat, Dr. Hume, but I never would have thought of that half-angle transformation." Little Allie twirled the chalk thoughtfully in his fingers for a moment, and then, looking directly at the student, says, "I didn't either, Mr. Jackson, the first time I looked at the problem." But if I tried to tell all the stories current about Little Allie, there'd be no room for anything else. He literally dominated the campus for 60 years. He had the reputation of being a stern disciplinarian. Chancellor Powers had the reputation of being very unwilling to get mixed up in such matters. In fact, I've been told on good authority that he maintained contacts among the student body to keep information flowing into his office about possible problems that might be brewing. Now, we students believe that when he saw some disciplinary problem coming up, he would suddenly have to go to Chicago to an important meeting, leaving preferably on the 2 a.m. train, that number 6 that I came up on. And he would leave Vice Chancellor Hume in charge with precise instructions as to what to do if and when. So again and again it was Little Allie who had to sit at the table and say, "Ship him." When he did become chancellor in his own right in 1924, it was a different story. Many a naive freshman with a good academic record and no other blemishes on his record, would find himself let off with a stern admonition from Dr. Hume, while his upperclassman, upperclassman companion came in with a poor academic record and a string of appearances before the discipline committee, he would find himself invited to pack up and go home. Again, no due process, no anything. But it was like a breath of fresh air blowing across the campus. The story of the Bilbo incident has been better told by others who have access to facts that I don't have, particularly by A. Wigfall Green in his book, The Man Bilbo. I was rather startled to hear Dr. Hume refer to the incident rather casually some years later. "Oh," he says to me, "that was during the time after I was fired from the university by Bilbo." Joseph Neely Powers was chancellor while I was an undergraduate. He was an impressive-looking man with a magnificent head of white hair. His academic credentials were at least as good as those of the average faculty member of the day. He had had a good, if not a distinguished, career in educational circles. I had heard him speak in Columbia, Mississippi, in about 1910 or 12, when he was state superintendent of education. He was pushing for the creation of consolidated high schools in rural areas. And if my memory is correct, these were the ancestors of the agricultural high schools, which were the ancestors of our present junior colleges. I had no real dealings with him. It's my general policy not to cultivate the acquaintance of the big shots unless it's strictly in the line of business. He did not have the reputation in my crowd of being a strong chancellor. Bob Farley once told me that Powers used to call him in and quiz him about student attitudes and reactions. Bob's father, you know, had been dean of the law school. But getting tired of this sort of thing, Bob says he used to concoct horrendous answers to the questions. Oh, he would say, the students are all upset over that chancellor. I shouldn't be surprised if they didn't break out in a real rout in a few days. Oh, Mr. Farley, chancellor would reply, don't tell me that. There was one time, however, in which he showed real bravery. There was some kind of scandalous investigation going on, maybe even a lawsuit, concerning the relations between Bilbo and a certain red-haired woman in Jackson. And in the proceedings, she claimed that Chancellor Powers was involved, too. When news reporters asked him about it, his reply was, I'll be down to Jackson Monday morning, and Mrs. Powers will be with me, and the woman can prove her accusations, if she can, face to face. And that was the last anybody ever heard about that. You might fault him for having agreed to take the chancellor's place when Dr. Hume was fired. Others refused similar offers. A.P. Hudson was offered the chairmanship of English, I'm told, when Dr. Bishop was fired. But he refused to take the position under the circumstances and went to North Carolina for his Ph.D. and stayed there to create a distinguished career as a folklorist. On the other hand, you might argue that if you couldn't control the flow of events, you could at least come back and try to keep the school from absolutely collapsing until a new governor came in and rescued you. Powers was a good friend of my grandfather when he worked in the area of secondary education, and I would hate to think that grandfather was too poor a judge of character, so I'm inclined to give him the benefit of a doubt. No description of people on the campus would be complete without a mention of R. Malcolm Guess, YMCA secretary and dean of students. He was a graduate of Ole Miss of about 1916, more or less. He became a YMCA worker and was in France in World War I at Chaumont, I think I've got that right, where Pershing's headquarters was. Although he was YMCA and not combat, he came out of the war pretty well shaken up, and it took a year or two for him to pull himself together. He must have come back to Ole Miss in 1920 or 21. With my background, I hung around the YMCA hut in my off hours and soon met Malcolm. My room in Gordon was an ideal place to visit before supper, just down the hall from the entrance to the dining hall and yet out of the hubbub of the lobby. So Malcolm and I became quite intimate. Malcolm was an ideal Y man. He was gregarious. He was sincere. He often said he did his best work at the coffee counter of the grill. And soon he had all sorts of things going on, committees all over the place, Sunday afternoon meetings in rural churches, you name it. He was often accused of filling his YMCA cabinet with campus big shots, but the reverse was generally true. He was the one man on the campus, Iowa knew, who ran the one organization that looked at a raw freshman and asked, "Now what can we do for that man and what can we make out of him?" And so his Y men did often become big shots on the campus. His religious week was something else again. It got the whole campus involved. Luncheons, Dutch luncheons, speakers in classrooms, general assemblies in the Fulton Chapel. He was, all in all, an admirable man. An ardent Sigma Chi, too. And no doubt about it, he was a force for good on the campus. He was courting Susie Lee when he came here. He used to come down to my room and write a letter to his girl nearly every night while I wrote one to mine in Jackson. And we'd go down B Street to the depot and mail the letters on the 9 o'clock train going south. That way our girls could get them next morning. Beats what the present post office does. On one such walk, he invited me to come to his wedding during the Christmas holidays of 1921, I think it was. Now, I was just callow enough to accept and go down to Brookhaven for the wedding. Thus it came about that I was present at the 6 p.m. wedding of Susie Lee Perkins and R. Malcolm Guest, and saw Susie Lee, a tall, statuesque woman, come grandly down the staircase in their home, only to have the extra lights in the house blow every fuse in the fuse box and plunge the whole house in the utter darkness, with Susie Lee just halfway down the stairs. Mrs. Perkins didn't quite go into hysterics, but believe me, it was a near thing. I have saved the best of my old professors for the last. Dr. William Lee Kennan, another Hopkins man, a physical chemist brought back to teach chemistry by Dr. Muckenfuss, in my day professor of physics and astronomy. He was not just a good teacher. He was an unconventional one, but he was fascinating as a teacher and an exciting man to be around. He was universally known as Wild Bill because of the flamboyant stories he told and which were his trademark. He loved to teach, and he enthusiastically taught freshman classes, particularly astronomy. He admitted that he taught tolerated classes of 100 or more. Most of them interested only in satisfying a specific degree requirement, but he taught them for the sake of identifying a few good students and recruiting them into his physics classes and his advanced classes. Your present-day teacher, even the rawest new Ph.D., expects to teach a couple of advanced sections, conduct a graduate seminar, and do research. I often wonder where they think those well-trained undergraduates are coming from, whom they expect to populate their advanced sections. They all must believe in spontaneous generation. That's how I became a physics major. I had originally thought I wanted to be a chemical engineer, though I wasn't too sure what that was. After my first course in organic chemistry, in which I'd done well, I talked to the new chemistry teacher, Dr. Woollett, about what I should take next, and he was very vague, suggesting merely that I might try my hand at organic chemistry. But by this time, Dr. Kennan had recruited me into a one-credit-hour class in radio where we could learn the Morse code and play with the old 1 kilowatt spark transmitter at night that he had in the physics building. My sophomore year, I took general physics. And since I had done most of the standard experiments with Miss May Fletcher, Wire Bill cooked up other special and interesting experiments for me to do. He made it all so exciting that I never thought about chemistry again. That old spark transmitter had call letters 5YE. We were in the 5th Naval District. And the continuous wave voice transmitter we were putting together just as I left in 25 had call letters WCBH, which are the station letters of the present campus transmitter. Wild Bill's stories were proverbial on the campus. I have 2 or 3 cassettes full of them downstairs and a notebook with dozens of more to be recorded. I play with them not because of their literary or historical value, but because they keep alive my memories of a very fine gentleman, an inspiring teacher, and a friend whom I loved like my own father. That Wild Bill's success as a teacher was not just student popularity, but was real, is indicated by the fact that Dr. Beams, physics chairman of Virginia, once said he would take with no further questions any graduate student recommended by William Lee Kennan. When I was at Hopkins, he had managed to keep at least one PhD candidate on the Hopkins campus for years on end. When James Harder and I were registering for our first year at Hopkins, we came up to the end of a long day needing just one more signature on some sort of form. Everyone of importance seemed to have gone home. I was living and working in Washington at the time and certainly didn't want to have to come all the way back next day, take a day's annual leave. So we anxiously inquired at the registrar's office if there wasn't anybody who could sign for us. A young lady in the registrar's office finally suggested perhaps Dr. Joseph Ames, the provost, might still be around. Dr. Ames had been, up until that year, the longtime chairman of the physics department. So we looked up his office, and there he was. He took just one look at our forms. "Why," he says, "you must be Kennan's boys." "Yes, sir," we answered. "Well, very well," he said, and signed us in without another question. No description of those days would be complete without mentioning the Scribblers Club. Scribblers was a local chapter of a, quote, national, unquote, writers fraternity, Sigma Upsilon. Sigma Upsilon was about on a par with Alpha Phi Epsilon. It provided us with a pin that we could wear with some pride and not much else as a club. But Scribblers was something else again. It had from 3 to 5 faculty members and 2 student members for every faculty member. There were, in my time, 4 faculty: Bishop, Kennan, Bondrant, and Leathers, the medical dean. But after Leathers left, and before my time, they elected various other faculty members, but none of them stayed very long. They weren't clubbable, as Bondy used to say. We elected Dr. Calvin Brown, and that was a disaster socially. Dr. Brown was an undoubted scholar in his own rights and a man of far-ranging intellectual interests. But he had no sense of humor whatever and no liking for the chit-chat and badinage that characterized Scribblers. I'm afraid Dr. Brown was a little bit of an intellectual snob. Every fall, the club chose a general area for study. For example, the great letter writers. St. Paul, Madame de Sevigny pop into my mind. A research paper on one of these was assigned to a member for each meeting. We call these things simply papers.